Last year when Shahe and Clint told me about my topic for this year, I was a little bit nonplussed because I wasn't sure exactly what the topic even meant. And you know, as what I've learned is that this is a difficult topic. It can become very philosophical very quickly. And of course, it can become very theoretical. In fact, I think that as we look at natural law, it's one of those things that is often talked about, but very rarely defined. And I think that's where the difficulty comes, is in defining what natural law actually is. And so what we're going to do is we're going to approach this study tonight from a variety of angles and try to lay some groundwork for the various types of law, and of course what natural law is, and then finally what positive law is, specifically divine positive law, by which we are guided tonight. Of course, the New Testament record. But nonetheless, we need to understand that from the beginning of man's creation, man has always been regulated by something. Man has never been left without a law. And so the question is, as we look at this concept of divine positive law, we understand that God, of course, has spoken. We all agree that God has given us His Word, but before the written word, before God perhaps gave us the Old or New Testament, was there anything, or is there anything, inherent within the human condition, either in his natural environment or within himself, for that matter, that tells us how we ought to live? In other words, mankind in society, how does he know how to live? Now we would say, well, we turn to the New Testament. We turn to the Old Testament. We turn to the Scriptures, and rightly so. But what of those who have never had the Testaments that we enjoy today? What of those pagans, so-called, who live around the world that do not have the Gospel? What then dictates or guides them? Now before we discuss the concept of natural law, and we'll define that in a moment, I think there's some preliminaries that we have to understand. And these preliminaries to me, in reality, are the substrata or the base for everything else that we are going to assume. The first thing that I think we must understand is that God is. In other words, there has never been a time when God wasn't. God is past, He is present, He is future. And so any discussion of any kind of law, but especially natural law, must take into consideration that there has never been a moment in man's history when man was not regulated by something. Number two, God created the heavens and the earth. And of course, the Creator always puts within His creation some essence of Himself. If you were to go into a museum and you saw a Rembrandt, and you saw a Monet, you would know immediately that it was not the same artist that did those paintings, because something of that artist is in each of that painting, and those artists are certainly much different. Well, of course, natural law, as we will discuss, is that which is around about us, that which guides us just inherently. And I believe that there is a certain imprint within humanity that reflects the very nature of God Himself. And I believe that when we look at apologetics and we look at the cosmos and the things that go to prove God's existence, it's because God has placed Himself, as it were, in these things that reflect then the truth of His existence. Again, God has always had a law for mankind. God said might be the underlying phrase that we could apply to mankind, actually before mankind. Before man was even created, there was God speaking things into existence, speaking order. And then, of course, He spoke the natural order around us, the nature, the creation into existence. And then right down through the scheme of time, God has given the various laws, the patriarchal system, the Mosaic system, the Christian system. And then finally, when all of this is over, God's law, God's rule, His power and authority will still be all in all. Now God said, let us make man. And this is where I want to begin our study this evening, because when God created man, I believe that God placed within man, within his spiritual nature and even within his physical nature, some semblance of himself. You know, when Satan came to Eve, he tempted her. But have you ever asked on what basis did he tempt her? Now, he showed her the fruit, but notice what it says in Genesis 3:6. She saw that it was good, that it was delightful to the eyes, and would make her wise. Now, how did she know about those things? How did she know about the metaphysical qualities of goodness and delight and wisdom? Was it something God had told her about? Well, I don't believe there's any record of that. I think that within mankind, there is a certain ability to determine certain amounts of goodness. Now, we can dull those senses, and I think the world today has done that, but nonetheless, Eve knew intuitively that that fruit was good, that it was delightful to her eyes, and that perhaps it can make her wise. Now, whether we're talking about God's divine revelation, which would be what we would call positive law, or we're talking about nature and natural law, one of the things that we need to understand is all of it, again, comes from God. So in reality, natural law has a supernatural origin. And so natural law, the rules that go on to carry out this universe, are not less supernatural than that which God has revealed through His Word. It's just incomplete. It is more incomplete than that which God has spoken to us. And so, again, whatever we can deduce or whatever we decide about natural law, it will always have to be interpreted in light of God's direct and more complete revelation. Now, some, I think, argue that there is no such thing as natural law. And they will say things like, well, we can't understand it. We can't fully identify or define it. And so it must not exist. But I think the thing we need to understand is that we don't have to know something, everything about something, rather, for us to know that there is something to know. We don't have to know everything to know something. And so when we look at natural law, we don't have to understand all of its ramifications. In fact, I don't. In fact, the scholars that I've read after and the philosophers, they disagree. But I believe that there's enough out there as we just look with our common minds and reason about the world around us that we can say there's something beyond just direct revelation that is guiding humanity. The other thing that I want to notice very quickly, and probably will not get into this, but the fall, or Adam and Eve being cast from the garden, did not taint mankind's ability to look round about him and discern that there is a God and that God has certain rules. Now, many theologians will say, well, the fall, because man sinned, that tainted his reason. He's not able any longer to be able to really know that there's a God by looking at nature. I deny that. I believe that there is plenty of evidence, and I don't believe the fall did any damage to our ability as humans to reason. Well, let me just start with four theories of law, or four kinds of law. Now, we won't be able to develop each one of these. That's not our topic. But I think we'll be able to see the contrast in these laws by giving a brief definition and an introduction. Now, basically, as we look at law in general, there are four types. There is what we might call eternal law. We'll describe that in a moment. And then, of course, there is natural law, which is our topic tonight. There would be divine law, which, of course, would be revealed ultimately in the Old and New Testaments for us as Christians. And then there's something called human law, which arguably would be developed from a combination of what someone regarded as natural law and what someone regarded as an authoritative law from a higher source. For us in Western society, it has typically been Christianity. But nonetheless, it is natural law that we're going to be looking at primarily. But what is eternal law? Well, eternal law is kind of the big circle. It is, shall we say, the foundation for all law. It is the mind of God. And eternal law would be the divine wisdom, the very essence of God. Now, we can't comprehend that, partly because God has not revealed all of His mind. Now, we do know that God has revealed what He wants us to know, either through nature or through His will. But we don't know everything in the mind of God, else we would be God, would we not? And so the eternal law is that which supersedes. It's the law concept that is far above and under which law of every kind would fall. Now, natural law, which is our topic, is that which is inherent within the world around us or within us as people. It is that body of universal laws or principles that are derived from the natural order, from the fact that we are humans, and all humans have certain same characteristics. There are certain things that we can identify as being something that dictates humanity. And of course, I think Paul spoke of this in Romans 1:20. He says, "For since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes are clearly seen." Now, how are they seen? Well, they are seen in his creation. They are seen in the natural laws, the processes, the rules, the regulations, the warp and woof of the very culture and society around us in the cosmos to be able to know that there is a God. Now, human law is, again, as we noted, it would be that which humans come up with, those rules, those societal-based observations that man then would impose upon others. And sometimes this is called just positive law or human positive law, but in reality, it's that which man looks at nature then and then projects upon his fellow man. And of course, that can come in laws that are written about the government and so on and so forth. Well, then we have divine positive law. And just shorthand for that would be God's revealed word. It would be the sum total of all of the prescriptions that God has communicated to mankind, no matter how that's been communicated. Whether that would be in his natural order or in his revealed word. And typically, we think of it as his revealed word, and I think that is rightly so. So you have divine positive law over against natural law. And that's where our discussion tonight will primarily center, because there's a contrast that we want to make and look at between what we can learn about God, what we can learn about his will, what we can learn about our purpose in life by just looking around us versus digging in to the revealed word of God and finding what God tells us that that purpose is. Now, there are many religions that will go to natural law, and they simply look at what's out there and they deduce from their own reasoning what they believe mankind's purpose is or the nature of God. That's all well and good to a point. But the danger of that is our perception can be skewed. And sometimes we enter a situation with a bias that God's word would help correct. So we need, as we'll notice in a moment, divine revelation. Let me just go back historically and sort of set the stage. You know, through the centuries of mankind's existence, man has delved into these things. And it goes all the way back to the ancient philosophers, all the way up through, of course, men today like, Reinhold Niebuhr, and then, of course, men like C.S. Lewis and others. But nonetheless, there have been thinkers along the line that have come to the conclusion that there are indeed certain principles in the world, in the inherent makeup of mankind, his nature, that which surrounds us, so that then there is more to it than just us. There are things we can learn, in other words, from our natural order. Now, let's start here, though, before we look at the actual thinkers themselves. The theory goes like this, and I think it has some merit. Why is natural law discernible? When we look at the world around us, how is it that we can discern anything from it? Why is there anything in it? Well, I think there's two important reasons. Number one, there is an essence to everything as we look at nature. There are forms out there. There are things that bear the imprint. We may not know exactly what it's bearing, but it's bearing the imprint that tells us that obviously something is bigger than that thing. You know, you look at the stars, you look at the trees, you see the order in nature, and it can't help but lead you to the conclusion that there is something that is the ultimate of all of these things. And then finally, or secondarily, reality. You know, there are things that are just the way they are. Reality demands certain principles and that would have to be followed to promote the collective good of society. I mean, if there were no inherent principles, then would we even be able to have society? Well, that's the question I think that's important to ask. And then how is law, natural law, discernible? What would we look to? Of course, we say we look to God's word. That's true, but that's divine positive law. What would we look to in nature, or how would we determine that there is something out there that should direct us in a moral way in the world around us? How is that discernible? Well, I think there's two ways. Now, these are imperfect sources, and we have to be careful that we don't place too much emphasis or reliance upon either one of these. But number one, it's intuition. In other words, you know, I believe there is something, and this gets very fuzzy, I'll admit to you, it gets very gray. But I believe that within most of us, there are certain principles that we just know are right and wrong. Now, I can't explain that. That may seem very illogical, but I believe there are certain intuitive principles about fairness, justice, life that is within each of us. Now, we can take those principles and things that we see, and we can reason about them. We can think, okay, logically, if A and B, then C. But now the problem with that is while we may come to know more about what we have intuitively thought through reason, it can lead us to illogical conclusions because reasoning can be wrong. In fact, logic, even though something is logical, doesn't mean it's true. And so you see, these are imperfect sources, but I believe that God does give us intelligence. He gives us the ability as humans to reason, and as we will notice, these are starting places then for us to then begin our quest for God and truth. Now, Plato, if we go back to Plato. Plato was big on the essence of things. He called this the forms. And I realize this is a gross oversimplification, but example, how do we know that a chair is a chair? Well, you say, well, it has certain qualities of a chair. Yes, it has chairness, in other words. Or how do we know that a dog is a dog? Well, it has the qualities of a dog. It has various qualities of dogness. And so, you see, Plato would reason there's something above the dog itself that gives us dogness. There's something above the chair itself that gives us the qualities of chairness. And so then, all of these essences, these forms, if you will, that are out there allow us to classify a dog is not a cat. And if there is beauty on the spiritual side and metaphysical side, if there is beauty and justice, then someone like Plato would come along and say, well, then there must be an ultimate beauty and justice. There must be at least the concept of the ultimate beauty and justice, just like there would be the concept, shall we say, of the ultimate dog. And so everything has a form. Everything has an essence. And we are able then to look at that and deduce from that that somewhere out there, philosophically speaking, there is the ultimate of that thing. And so we see goodness in the world. We would say, well, maybe there's a good God. Maybe there is a just God. And so these are called the forms. Now, Aristotle came along, and he was all about the nature of things. He said, you know, there are things in nature that have purpose, and something is good when it accords with what it was designed to do. For example, an oak tree, that's a good tree. And it's good if it fulfills that for which it was created, if it gives lots of shade, if it's healthy, if it produces acorns for the squirrels, that's a good oak tree because it is fulfilling its oak tree-ness. It is fulfilling its nature. And so then, as we then go to the further theories, humans then would be good, or they would be flourishing, if you will, when they were doing what it was designed for them to do, which would be, of course, moral goodness and so on and so forth. But the point is this. Why did Aristotle think that there was something by which we could judge the nature or the goodness or the purpose of something? Because he believed there's a natural order, something above that which we see that dictates where everything else falls. Now, St. Thomas Aquinas, and in the Christian world, so-called, St. Thomas Aquinas in the 13th century was probably the greatest writer about natural law. But natural law to him was the rationale, the intuitive rationale, or what he called the intuitive participation in the eternal law. In other words, you have the mind of God out there. And in that mind of God, of course, is everything that we can and everything that we cannot know. But he would say that the mind of God has, of course, created the world, it's created our environment, it's created the very bodies and the nature of ourselves. And so something within us, inherent, intuitive, is partaking of that divine nature. And we know it. We know certain things are right and wrong because we are simply partaking of that greater law called the eternal law. Now, C.S. Lewis, one of the greatest thinkers, I think, of the 20th century, he has the same concept in that he believed in what we might call natural light. Now, natural light would be that which we just sort of, again, intuitively know. He believed that the universe was a good universe, that we can just look at the universe, and because of those good inherent qualities in nature, we can come to know about God. We can use that as a starting point, in other words. And if you'll read his writings, such as the Chronicles of Narnia, which many of you, if you homeschool, that's almost a necessary reading anymore. But you'll see the goodness of nature within the Chronicles of Narnia. It's something that he just is believed is pervasive and totally intuitive in the world around us. And by the way, while I'm on C.S. Lewis, if you have never read Mere Christianity, or you've never listened to it, I would recommend it. It's a pretty heavy slog, but C.S. Lewis deals with not only this concept, but so many basic concepts, from prayer to just who we should be as Christians. And while we might not have agreed with his philosophical theology totally, we can learn a lot from men like this. So now let's go to our topic in earnest. And for the next 24 minutes, let's look at natural law. Now, we've defined natural law, again, as that which is around us. But let's break it down. By natural, what we mean is that which makes a certain thing, let's call it X, to be that certain thing. In other words, it is that which gives X to Xness. It is that which gives dogness to a dog. It is that which gives catness to a cat. It is that which gives humanity to a human. It is the very essence of who they are, what that thing is. And by law, we simply mean that which is normative, or that which is an ought, that which creates and dictates under any certain circumstances what that thing, whether it's a dog or cat or human, should do. In other words, again, we're going back to almost the Aristotelian type of concept here. We have a natural thing that then is in a law, not in the sense of a law like someone makes for the government, but a law that dictates the oughts or the norms for that particular thing. Now, here is what I think one definition that has been given, and it works, I think, fairly well. Four things in natural law. Natural law is that order or rule of human conduct based on human nature as created by God, knowable by all men through human intuition and reasoning alone, independent of divine revelation, and thus normative for all men and for all beings. So you have four things. You have an order or a rule based on human nature. In other words, because man is the way he is, because he was created to be able to live in this world, there are certain things about man that just are. And this is knowable to some degree by simply looking, observation, reasoning. And it is knowable to all men. So it's not just Americans, it's not just Africans, it is humanity in general. Now, here's the real question. Does natural law really exist? Now, scholars have come down on both sides of this thing, and for me, I've come down on the side that I believe there is natural law. Now, again, to define it, to be able to quantify, qualify it, is a difficult thing because you can't necessarily find natural law in one book that you just read all the rules of natural law. But I believe there are real oughts. There are real senses of justice and love and mercy and grace and those things that are built into the human condition. Just like I said with Eve, how did she know that that tree was good for food? How did she find it delightful? What is that that gives her the ability to recognize delight? What gives her the ability to recognize goodness? What gives her the ability to recognize wisdom? Well, would it not be because God, a good God who is wise and delightful, made her? That's the point then of natural law. And I think we see this even amongst children or even amongst adults. You know, if you begin to argue with someone about some concept, they soon will say, that's not fair. And you'll say, of course it's fair because I'm making the rules. I say, no, you can't make those rules. You see, everyone will appeal at some point in time, especially in a controversy, whether it's children or not, to some ultimate standard. Now, why are they appealing to that standard if no such thing exists? You see, all of us, I believe, when it's all said and done, inherent within our very makeup and our very nature, we understand that things, certain things, are just because that's the way they are. There is a certain inherent right and a certain inherent wrong. Now, we may not know everything about right and wrong, as we'll notice in a moment, but we can know something about right and wrong, and that then gives us a place to begin to look for the ultimate right and wrong found in God's revealed word. Now, we can deny natural law theory, but then I think there's some consequences. Number one, if we deny that there is even such a thing as natural law, then what we're saying is that outside the revealed law of God, there's nothing unnatural or immoral about what pagans do. Now, none of us believe that. Even if it weren't for God's revealed word about some of the atrocities that we see in the world, we know those things are wrong because there's a certain natural right and wrong. Morality, then, if there is no natural construct, morality becomes solely the construct of either religion or those that are in authority, those who impose their views upon others. And that morality, then, is fluid. It comes and goes as different rulers, different powers, different laws, different authorities come and go. And I think the most important point for me, I think this resonated with me about as much as anything, and that is, if you were to take those of us who are Christians, and if you were to take those who are pagan, who have never heard about Jesus, if there is no such thing as natural law, then where do they start to even begin to want to search after God? Where do they start to even begin to move or wiggle towards an ultimate greater truth? You see, I believe that there is natural law that gives, as we will see, the starting point for all mankind. Now, natural law is not clear in every facet. It's simply a starting place. For example, a man may kill his enemy, but I believe that within mankind there is something intuitively and instinctively in him, if he's normal, that he doesn't kill a friend. Now, of course, a woman may not love her husband, but when a woman is normal, as we would say, she has a natural affection for her child. That's what makes abortion so much of an atrocity today. People are living by, well, they've abandoned even natural law, you see. And so now we've got all kinds of crazy things going on. Paul dealt with that in Romans 1. But nonetheless, natural affection. A man may not know that he can't be a polygamist. Natural law might not say you can't have 5, 6, 10, 12, 15 wives, but he knows he can't have every woman his wife. Now, why does he know that? Well, you could say, well, societal rules. Yes, perhaps, but how does society know that? You see, it comes at some point, there's got to be a stopping point as to why things are as they are. A person may hate their life, but in their right mind, they're usually not going to take their life. Why? Because there's something within us, the will to live, something within us that dictates that life is precious. What could that be? Other than God, who is the ultimate giver and the ultimate of life, has placed life within us. Now, natural law doesn't make us autonomous. We can't look at natural law and say, well, I can be saved by natural law. It is not enough. Man needs more than natural law. All natural law does is it levels the playing field. Natural law cannot speak to the wholeness of man. Man is a physical creature, true. Man has to deal with others in culture and society, true. But man also is a spiritual being that needs to come into a right relationship for his own good and for his own conscience and for his own eternity with God. Natural law can't do that. Natural law can only give you, even in certain instances, how to act towards your fellow man, let alone God. And then, of course, natural law is often obscured. It can be obscured by our passions, by bad customs, by our biases. And so we need, beyond natural law, something to guide us toward the ultimate light. Now, Alexander Campbell said all light comes from above. Or at least he's reputed to have said that. And I think that's right. All light, whether natural or direct, comes from God. So God is leading, if you will, or at least giving us an environment to find Him, no matter where we are. If we are in the darkest jungles of some country, there is enough natural law or essence of the way things are to find God, or at least begin to search for Him. If we are living in a Christian nation, we have the combination and the beauty of natural law and God's revealed law. So again, it levels the playing field. Natural law addresses man's relationship to the creation. But now, divine law, what is also called divine positive law, addresses man's relationship with the Creator. Now, those are distinctions that sometimes bleed and lap into one another, but nonetheless, we can know more about the creation from natural law than, of course, the Creator. And in divine law, we will learn more about the Creator, will we not, than creation. And so both are necessary. Natural law is the starting point. Natural law addresses man's relationship to the creation. And divine positive law addresses man's relationship with the Creator. You know, I think it's very important to understand that God gives light to all who will see, whether we're talking about natural revelation or divine positive revelation. And God gives revelation through His Word to all who will listen. And so, again, both of these things are important. Both go hand in glove. Both are of divine origin, and both, I think, work together. Natural law will never contradict, at least to my way of thinking, and so far I haven't been able to think of an example, contradict divine positive law. Now, divine positive law may contradict what you assume natural law is teaching you, but not the other way around. Natural law focuses on reason. Divine law focuses on revelation. Natural law, as Ron Corder is supposed to have said, I don't know if Ron gets quoted sometimes when he didn't say things, but nonetheless, natural law tests our love to our fellow man, and divine law tests our faith. I don't know if Ron said that or not, but I like it. In fact, I'd like to say it's me that said that, but I didn't. Well, I said it, but it was said it because Ron said it. But nonetheless, natural and divine law are two different things. Now, let's spend the next 15 minutes, the last part of our trying to prove from what we would call the definitive source, the concept of natural law. Is there such a thing as natural law? Now, we've, you know, bantered around philosophy here and philosophers and Plato and Aristotle and C.S. Lewis and others, but is there really such a thing? Was Thomas Aquinas right? Well, let's see if there's any biblical evidence. Now, we've already noted Eve in the garden and on what she was basing the ability to see beauty and wisdom and all from. There had to be something larger than herself that apparently was already looming. But does Scripture indicate that there is a natural law or a natural code built in within the fabric, the warp and the woof of our lives? I'm going to say yes. And of course, I think many passages seem to indicate this. And I believe there are many verses that seem to be able to be interpreted only if you start with the presupposition that there is right and wrong, without even God having to specify right and wrong. Let's look at the Old Testament. Does the Old Testament give any examples? Well, you know, when God created Adam, you know, he was the highlight of God's creation. That God said that the creation of Adam and Eve were very good. But now, he then says it's not good that man be alone. So there's something that's not good. On what was the basis of the good and not good? Well, I believe there is a concept, because, of course, ultimately God, of a natural makeup of Adam, the way God made Adam, because he was a man, because he's human, God, within that Adam creature or creation, saw that there were things that were not good. There was a certain thing that needed to complete his goodness. So there's a concept outside of Adam of good and wrong, right, wrong, evil, so on and so forth. And of course, I think we find that hinted of here in Genesis, the first chapter. Now, Jethro, in Moses' day, you remember Moses there is trying to do everything basically for the children of Israel, and his father-in-law, who was not an Israelite, who was not a man of the Torah, comes to him and says, you're working yourself to death. Jethro did not have divine positive revelation. He did not have the Torah. He didn't even have granny. But nonetheless, he knew that Moses was going the wrong direction. How did he know that? Because there are certain things that are just right and wrong. Now, Israel is a light to the nations. I think this is interesting. You know, God set Israel to be a light to the nations. Now, how in the world can someone be a light to the nations if it is impossible for that to whom they are lighting or being lit for to observe and recognize light from darkness? You see, we can get ourselves in darkness and we can mess up our senses, but apparently in Israel's day, and I believe even in our day, if we admit it, people know at least enough about right and wrong to be able to understand that when we do something right, it's right. Israel was a light to the nations. In fact, they were told in Deuteronomy 4, be careful to observe these things, For this is your wisdom and your understanding in the sight of the nations or the peoples that will hear of your statutes. Now, how will they hear of the statutes and know that those statutes are good if there's not some concept of right and wrong within them? Now, someone say, well, maybe back in the patriarchal age, they learned goodness from Adam and Eve. And I admit that is an interesting concept or an interesting avenue of discussion. Pagans, you know, in the book of Isaiah, Isaiah condemns the pagans for taking a tree that they knew was not a god and yet cutting it down and making it into a god. And it's almost as if Isaiah is saying, this is ridiculous. You should know intuitively that that which you bake for your bread, to cook your bread, is not that then which you worship. And so there's something intuitive, inherent, a natural law behind this particular concept. And of course in Jeremiah, Jeremiah says, even the stork of the heaven knows her appointed times, and the turtle dove, the swift, and the swallow observe the time of their coming, but my people do not know the judgment of the Lord. Now, the concept here is a contrast between what nature automatically knew and what God's people should have automatically have known. So I think this argument would not have worked for Jeremiah had there not been something behind this that truly did point toward a greater, higher, overarching law. Psalm 19, I believe you have here not a tautology, but a parallel. You have God declaring his glory through the heavens, and then David later saying the law of the Lord is perfect. He is giving us a parallel. You see, these two things are the witnesses of God. God declares his glory through natural law, but he also converts the soul through divine positive revelation. So both then are at work. Nature has a rhythm and has an order. And to everything, there is a season and a time for every purpose under heaven. And of course, that natural order is what the writer of Ecclesiastes talks about in Ecclesiastes 3. And so then, there does seem to be a natural law underlying some of the things in the Old Testament. Well, what about the New Testament? Well, you know, Jesus, I believe, bases some of his teaching on natural law. You know, sometimes Jesus appeals to nature, to that which was intuitive, that which is just built in, and uses that as a base for then telling us what we should do directly. You know, when Jesus says, take no thought for your life, and then he compares the life of birds and the fowls and the seeds and the plants, he's saying, listen, there is something built into nature that is good, that is care, that takes care of them. Therefore, you ought to be able to reason that God does the same. That's natural law that he's speaking of there. Jesus, when he gives what we call the golden rule, that's a certain rule. By the way, it actually, the concept predates Jesus, obviously on this earth anyway, because it's the idea of the golden rule. But nonetheless, it teaches a certain understanding of reciprocity. We all understand that we want to be treated well, so we treat others. Now, where did we get that notion? Not through divine positive commandment per se, although it is there in this statement in Matthew 7, but in the concept of just consequences, natural consequences and natural law. Jesus appeals to the eternal principle of natural law in showing that a man and a woman will leave and cleave to one another and become one flesh. And this, of course, would for all time rule out any, possibility of anything other than a heterosexual marriage. So Jesus appeals to natural laws even in his ministry. Now Paul does the same thing, I believe. And we won't have time to discuss in detail some of these things, but let me just give you a little bit of a spackling of what Paul deals with. Now, in Acts 14, they come to Lystra, and you remember, of course, people are wanting to worship them. And Paul rebukes them for this. But then he says in verse 17, speaking of God and his nature and how we should turn from idols to serve the living God, he says, nevertheless, God did not leave himself without witness in that he did good, gave us rain from heaven and fruitful seasons, filling our hearts with food and gladness. So there is the concept here, Paul is saying, of look around you. Nature teaches you something about law, natural law. Paul, in his sermon to the Areopagus in Acts 17, he speaks of us living and moving within God and groping after Him. And He says we're His offspring. And he talks about the divine nature that should have been evident just from looking at the world around us. Beautiful way that Paul addresses people who did not know about God, but should have known there was at least a God that was not an idol. And then, of course, Romans 1. You know, Romans 1 is that classical passage, or that classic passage, I think, about, you know, natural law, Romans 1 and 2. And Paul speaks of this this moral degradation that the Gentiles had fallen into, unspeakable things they were doing. And he says, it should have been evident to them that these things were wrong. He says they should have been able to look at what was made and come to the realization that God has a certain order and power over man. And he says, because of that, they're without excuse. And he says, the Gentiles know the judgment of God. Well, how do they know the judgment of God? Because there are certain things, I believe, inherent within the condition of nature around us and within, of course, our own knowledge that should lead us away, at least from certain actions. You know, the Gentiles' actions demonstrated that they had some kind of a moral compass. Now, oftentimes they violated, it seems, that moral compass. But, you know, Paul speaks of the works of the law written on Gentiles' hearts. And I think we have the man here tonight, but here's what he says on this passage in Romans. He says, both Jews and Gentiles then had an opportunity to obtain justification according to the principle of law. Now, the Jews, by receiving and keeping divinely inspired law from God, that is the written code, and the Gentiles, by receiving an unwritten internal moral code written on their hearts. And so the concept here then is, or the idea here, is that the Jews were going to be judged by law. The Gentiles were going to be judged by law, maybe not the same law, but all law does is condemn anyway. And so then, both need Jesus Christ. That's the point that Paul is making in Romans 1 and 2. Summing it up with Romans 3:23, we all need Christ. The Jews need Him, the Greeks need Him, and we all need Him. All have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. So, what's the bottom line? The bottom line is that we all need Jesus. None of us are left without a law. And so then, in my last 2 minutes, ask the question, will natural law judge us? Now, I think that's an interesting question because, law in and of itself condemns. It takes something else to justify. But law condemns, and I think we might think of it this way, and this is maybe a little overstatement, a little too simplistic, but natural law certainly judges all men here. But I believe Christ will judge all men in the hereafter. So we don't escape the judgment of natural law. Natural law does condemn. It does at least give us a starting point, a level playing field, a starting line to search after God. And yet, it will be Christ who will ultimately judge us. And so I think that's important for us to know. We will be judged. And the question is not what law will judge us, but what source of justification is out there. And it's not going to be found in natural law. The source of justification is Jesus Christ. The source of justification is the gospel. In fact, Paul in Romans 2:12 through 16 speaks of this when he speaks of the day when God will judge the secrets of men by Jesus Christ according to His gospel. And so it is the gospel of Christ that is the ultimate solution. And if I may sum up with this beautiful passage that Paul in Romans 1:16, we quote it all the time, but Paul says, I'm not ashamed of the gospel of Christ. You see, he's showing that natural law is not going to cut it. And even the law of Moses is not going to cut it. It's the gospel of Christ. It's the good news of the gospel of Christ. He says it's the power of God to salvation to everyone who believes, to the Jew first and also to the Greek, for therein the righteousness of God is revealed from faith to faith. For the just shall live by faith.